Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
This is The Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by LDSAgents.com. The Interpreter Foundation exists to encourage study of the gospel and faithfulness to the church by making the latest scholarship available in its journal, publishing books, holding seminars, creating documentary films, and by providing roundtable discussions of the scriptures. You can find us at interpreterfoundation.org, where you can find all of our materials, including these radio programs, which are posted as podcasts. You can also subscribe to this show on iTunes or through any of the other podcast apps on Apple and Android devices. If you like this show, tell your friends about us and write a review on iTunes or in your favorite site for podcast apps. I'm Steve Densley, and tonight I'm joined in the studio by co-host Mark Johnson and on the phone by Professor Matthew Bowen from BYU Hawaii. Are you with us, Professor Bowen?
Aloha, Steve. Aloha, Mark.
Aloha. Looks like we've got you on the phone. Okay, Professor Bowen, we're a little worried about whether that was going to work or not, and looks like we're doing all right. We're pleased to have one of the authors that has published with the Interpreter Foundation recently. Like I said, we publish a journal, has an article or two or three come out every week, and one of the things we like to do is review books that Latter-day Saints may be interested in, for better or for worse. And this evening, we have two articles we're discussing because the same author published them back-to-back about the same author. They're different books, but the author that's joining us tonight is Spencer Krause. Spencer, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Okay. Excited to have you here. Spencer is a student from Brigham Young University majoring in computer science and minoring in modern Hebrew and ancient Near Eastern studies. And he works with Book of Mormon Central as a research associate and also a research assistant for Lincoln Blummel, studying early Christianity in the New Testament. What are you working on right now at Book of Mormon Central, Spencer?
I've been helping with the research a lot, writing some articles for our website. Especially with Bible Central, we've been working on getting a lot of new content for that.
Well, it sounds that sounds great. I've been really happy to see the content that's been coming out of Book of Mormon Central and Pearl of Great Price Central and Doctrine and Covenant Central and now Bible Central. I guess you guys are going to be working on stuff for the New Testament coming up for this next year, aren't you?
Yes, we are.
Well, very good. We'll be excited to see that. I was also excited to see the work that you've been doing responding to Jonathan Neville. There are, like I said, we've got two articles. This last one that came out this last week. I'm worried I'm going to get these mixed up on which one came out which. I think it was Jonathan Edwards' Unique Role in an Imagined Church History that just recently came out, right?
Yes.
And then the week before that, the article is entitled An Unfortunate Approach to Joseph Smith's Translation of Ancient Scripture. Now, the books that we're talking about here, we've got one called Infinite Goodness, Joseph Smith, Jonathan Edwards, and the Book of Mormon. This was published by Digital Legends Press. And then the other one is A Man That Can Translate, Joseph Smith and the Nephite Interpreters, also Digital Legends Press. What do you know about Digital Legends Press? What kind of a publishing house is that?
I know it's based in Salt Lake City, and they've published most, if not all, of Jonathan Neville's books and other in his group of research associates, you could say.
Right. So is that basically the publication arm of the Heartland Group?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Why don't you explain for us who the Heartlanders are? What do the Heartlanders believe? What position are they taking?
one of their big positions is that the Book of Mormon took place in North America, in the heartland of the United States. And lately they've also been, most of them have been against Joseph Smith using a seer stone to translate the Book of Mormon. I would say are their two big talking points at the moment.
Right. And so with respect to Joseph Smith using a seer stone, you responded to that in your article, an unfortunate approach to Joseph Smith's translation of ancient scripture, right?
Yes.
So, you know, one of the things that is very confusing to me is, and I'm not sure you addressed this directly in your paper, so let me ask you about this off the top of my head. Well, maybe you don't know the answer to this question. I mean, I suppose I'm kind of asking you to get into their heads. Why is this such a big deal to them? You know, they are really, I've seen a lot of people really upset, really strenuously pushing this idea that Joseph Smith never used a seer stone, and that instead he used seer stones that are sometimes called Nephite interpreters or sometimes called Urim and Thummim. So, you know, it's either the two stones that were given to him by Moroni or one stone that he found himself. Why does it make such a big difference to them which stones Joseph Smith used?
I can only talk about what I read, you know. Like you said, we can't really get in their heads, but I know that one of the points that Jonathan Neville raises in his book is he believes that if Joseph were to use a seer stone that he found by himself, then what use would there be for the golden plates? And therefore, the Book of Mormon may not be historical, according to... I believe I spelled that out in a first paragraph. Well, not the first paragraph, but one of the paragraphs closer to my opening of the paper. And for some reason, it seems like that's where it goes for him, at least, is the historicity of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, and, you know, I see people just really aggressively going after this issue and making statements to the effect that there's no evidence that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon using a seer stone in a hat. You know, and then when you push them on that, they'll say, well, there's no evidence from credible witnesses, right? And so what can you tell us about that? What evidence is there that Joseph Smith used the seer stone in a hat to translate the Book of Mormon?
Well, we actually have a lot of firsthand witnesses to the translation of the Book of Mormon. David Whitmer said that he and his whole father's family saw the translation take place. Elizabeth Ann Whitmer Cowdery said that she would sit in the room day after day watching Joseph with his face in the hat dictate the Book of Mormon, and Oliver would write it down, or whoever the scribe was at the time. And Martin Harris was another firsthand witness who was also a scribe to the translation process, and he talked about Joseph using a seer stone in a hat, sometimes even one of the stones from the Nephite interpreters he'd take out of their silver bowls and put that in a hat. And he even once tried to swap the seer stone. And there's almost all of the historical accounts seem to go into, at least be open to allowing a seer stone when they don't directly mention it.
Yeah, one of the stories I really like is from Martin Harris, where he is wondering himself about Joseph Smith's ability to translate. And so he performs a little bit of a test. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Martin Harris and Joseph Smith were down skipping rocks by a river. And as you said, Steve, they were Martin was especially wondering at this time, and so he looked down and he saw a stone that looked pretty similar to Joseph Smith's seer stone, and so he took that with them Joseph's home, where they were translating at the time, and eventually was able to swap Joseph's seer stone with this stone that he found by the river. And so when Joseph went to continue translating, he said, you know, Martin, what is the matter? All is as dark as Egypt. And then Martin admits, like, oh, I wanted to stop the mouths of fools, he said. So I saw, and he admits what he did to Joseph, and because people were telling Martin that Joseph was just memorizing some tidbit of information beforehand and fooling Martin. But by doing this, Martin saw that Joseph wasn't just memorizing and reciting, that he actually did have a seer stone that he could use to translate, and he wasn't being made a fool of.
Yeah, I think that's a great story. I mean, one of the more recent narratives or arguments about how Joseph Smith is the actual author of the text is that he worked this up over the course of a few years, memorized the text, and then, you know, duped Martin Harris and Oliver Cowdery and many others. Emma, you know, everybody, everybody around him, somehow didn't recognize that he was memorizing this text over the course of a number of years. And then he is putting on this performance where he is pretending to translate, but that really what he's doing is just reciting the words that he had already memorized. And so this story, I think, flies in the face of that theory. Now, one thing they might say in response is that, you know, well, you know, obviously Joseph Smith just recognized the difference in the stones, you know, and so as part of, you know, extending this ruse, he pretended that he wasn't able to translate because he recognized that Martin had switched to stones. What would you say to that?
I would say that that's an illogical assumption, to say the least. If Joseph has his face in a hat to block out all the light, and you have a dark colored stone at the bottom of a dark hat, it would be pretty hard to tell the difference one stone from the other, just based on appearance.
Yeah, well, I think that's a pretty good point. So one of the other issues that comes up is the use of the term Urim and Thummim, and how there are lots of statements that to the effect that Joseph Smith used the Urim and Thummim to translate. So the argument goes, since he's saying, and others are saying, use the Urim and Thummim, it could not have been a single seer stone. How do you respond to that?
Well, there are quite a few historical accounts, some from David Whitmer, that actually call Joseph's single seer stone a Urim and Thummim. And even in D&C 130, Joseph talks about a white seer stone that will be given to people, you know, a single stone that will be a Urim and Thummim. And, you know, Urim and Thummim in the Bible was two different stones. It's just a biblical term that was, I think, applied to multiple items used to translate the Book of Mormon.
Right. So does the Book of Mormon ever use the term Urim and Thummim?
No, it just says interpreters or directors.
All right. So the fact that the saints may be using the term Urim and Thummim to describe things other than the Nephite interpreters doesn't contradict the Book of Mormon.
No, it doesn't.
All right. Well, I don't know. Maybe we ought to talk about Jonathan Neville for a moment. Who is Jonathan Neville?
He is a large figure in this, the Heartlander movement, as you said. I'm not sure what more would you like.
Well, he's an attorney.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of training does he have in, you know, history or in you know, foreign languages or any of that?
No, he has no training in Hebrew which especially in A Man That Can Translate, where he deals with Isaiah and tries to say that Isaiah was just memorized and recited, he could have used a lot of Hebrew training to double check what he was saying before he said it. He's not a trained historian as far as I know of.
Now, he also operates, I think, multiple websites, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
And these are all pretty much publishing the same kind of information. As far as I can tell, I'm not really sure I see the distinction between the various websites.
Yeah,
is there
either
one?
I know he has one main blog, but yeah, he has multiple blogs. I don't even know how many anymore. But yeah, through the years, I've seen he's mostly just rehashing the same things that he said in years previous.
Yeah, I've heard Rod Meldrum, who is sort of the leader, I guess, of the Heartland Movement, refer to Jonathan Neville as, I can't remember if he used the term their top scholar or not, but that was kind of the gist of what he was saying. When he was being asked about some of these issues, and Rod Meldrum basically said, I don't know, you have to ask Jonathan Neville. So it sounds like that these books, A Man That Can Translate and Infinite Goodness, Joseph Smith, Jonathan Edwards, and the Book of Mormon, are two of the books I suppose Rod Meldrum might refer us to as representing Jonathan Neville's best work. Has Jonathan Neville published other books?
Yes, he's published one on his take on Book of Mormon geography. He's published one on Oliver Cowdery's Letter 7, and a few others. I believe he published another one on Book of Mormon geography like 2 years ago.
Okay, and are these all published through Digital Legends Press, or are they self-published, or how does he go about?
As far as I know, they're all through Digital Legends Press.
Okay. Well, have you read any of those other works?
I have one of them on my bookshelf. I've looked through it a little bit. I responded to one claim previously, not in these papers, but other than that, no, I don't have his other books.
Well, one of the interesting things at the end of your papers, you thank some people who have contributed to giving you some feedback and support. One of the people that you thank is Peter Pan. Who is Peter Pan, and why is it you're so grateful to him?
Yeah, Peter Pan is a blogger who goes by a pseudonym, and he has this blog where he's responded multiple times to Jonathan Neville's claims, and I've emailed with him before, and he offered me a lot of encouragement to continue writing these reviews.
What's the name of his blog?
Neville Neville-land.
Neville Neville-land, by Peter Pan.
Yes.
And so he's responding to the claims of Jonathan Neville.
Yes.
All right. So what's the gist of this book, A Man That Can Translate, Joseph Smith and the Nephite Interpreters? What is his main thesis?
So his main thesis in this book is to show that Joseph Smith did not use the seer stone to translate. And so he makes multiple claims, one of which is that Joseph Smith just did a demonstration. He calls it his demonstration hypothesis, where because people were kept bugging him about the translation of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith just threw something together and threw a seer stone in a hat and said, okay, I'll just do this to get you guys off my back. And then he would pretend to translate when he really recited Isaiah 13 through 21 from memory.
So was there any text of the Book of Mormon produced before he allegedly demonstrated, engaged in this, demonstration?
Yeah, so his theory is that Joseph Smith had translated all of the Book of Mormon up until the Isaiah chapters of Second Nephi, which would be, let's see, that would be, let's see, oh, sorry, it was, yeah, like this middle of second Nephi, you know.
Yeah, up to Isaiah. Yeah. So before that, then, were there any witnesses to the translation? I mean, what does Jonathan Neville claim Joseph Smith was doing? Was he transcribing this himself?
Yeah, so he claims that Joseph Smith only used the Nephite interpreters and would perform a scholarly translation of the characters on the plates, as in one would translate like if I were to translate the Hebrew Bible, I would look at the, you know, Biblia Hebraica and, you know, work from that and use my knowledge of Hebrew to translate. It seems like Joseph Smith would have done the same thing in Neville's hypothesis.
So is Jonathan Neville claiming that Joseph Smith had any knowledge of Hebrew at all at this time?
He did not claim that Joseph had any knowledge of Hebrew at all. I'm still not entirely sure where the Nephite interpreters would fit into this. He did say in his book that the translation was inspired because Joseph used the Nephite interpreters, but it was still a translation because Joseph looked at the Reformed Egyptian characters and would translate them as we would expect a modern translation to occur.
Yeah, what does he mean by that? Because what I would expect, I've done some translation myself. I oversaw the translation of a former version of the Hmong hymn book for the church. So, you know, I've engaged in translation, and one of the things that you do is you get out the documents. You know, you look at the document you're translating, but then you also rely on dictionaries. You maybe rely on, you know, in my case, hymn books, you know, looking at what people have done with different versions of you know, translations, kind of scrutinizing various texts. So what would Jonathan Neville, how does he describe Joseph Smith's process if he's going through a scholarly process in translating those chapters?
He says that he believes it would take about 2 hours a page of a manuscript page to come up with a translation. And because we have these accounts where Joseph Smith would just pick up translating where he left off, that must imply then that Joseph Smith would just start from the top of a new page of the plates and move down instead. And so it seems that, according to Jonathan Neville, Joseph Smith would look at a character in Reformed Egyptian and work it out in his mind as to what that should say, and sometimes he'd have to reformulate what he'd say, such as in Alma, where it talks about the anti-Nephi Lehis bearing their weapons of peace, or they buried their weapons of war for peace. That's where Neville would say that Joseph Smith wanted to reformulate what he had just translated to capture the meaning of the Egyptian Reformed Egyptian characters.
So what is the mechanism by which Joseph Smith is translating? Is this, you mentioned how it's like an academic process. Is there a revelation involved in this, according to Neville?
I would believe that he does believe that there was revelation involved. It wasn't entirely clear, however, in his book, where the academic process would begin or end and revelation would take over.
You know, one of the other questions I think that some of our listeners may have is, why a seer stone? Why is it that Joseph Smith would not have simply continued to use Nephite interpreters throughout this process?
One of the things with the Nephite interpreters is they were very large and bulky. You know, you had a big breastplate, and everything. And so a lot of it was for comfort. It was much easier for Joseph Smith to put one of the stones in his hat and read from that instead of having to constantly have this veil up between him and his translator, and he'd, you know, have to put on the breastplate with the Nephite interpreters in them. It was just, I think, more out of convenience than anything.
Well, when you say put one of the stones, what you're talking about, I guess, is taking one of the stones out of the Nephite interpreters and putting in a hat.
Yeah, there are some sources that say that that's what he would do. He would use either his seer stone that he found, or he would take one of the seer stones out of the Nephite interpreters. Martin Harris talks about that.
Jonathan Neville also makes a big deal out of the fact that the Nephite interpreters are referred to in Scripture. And so if you don't believe that Joseph Smith used the Nephite interpreters, then you must not believe in the Scriptures. Is there anything we can find in the Scriptures about seer stones?
Yeah. For one, the Nephite interpreters are just two seer stones wrapped in silver bows. The Israelite Urim and Thummim, a lot of scholars believe that it was just two separate seer stones. Well, we would call them seer stones. I would think a white stone and a black stone that they would use to cast lots or something. And so the term is applied to seer stones. And even in Alma 37, this is another point that Neville tries to contest in his book, but it talks about a stone prepared for the Lord's servant that would bring information out of darkness unto light. And Alma uses the same language to describe this stone as he does to describe the Nephite interpreters.
Do we know where the Nephite interpreters came from?
Yeah, they were the ones that were buried with the plates in New York.
Well, do we know where Moroni got them?
I am not entirely certain that we know for sure. I believe Michael Ash recently, in his latest book published by Fair, said that they may not be the ones given to the brother of Jared originally. I would have to double-check his book, though, but others might say that they were from the stones that were originally given to the brother of Jared.
Yeah, yeah, I'm aware of there's a little bit of, I guess there's a unsettled discussion going on about that, you know. So there's one line of thought that where the brother of Jared prepares these stones for the voyage, he, you know, takes them to the Lord and asks the Lord to touch them. That two of these ended up, you know, in this bow, you know, or these, I guess I kind of think of them as frames, you know, like for lenses, for glasses, and that, you know, over time those were passed down to the time that Moroni received them and passed them on to Joseph Smith. You know, I suppose there's some reason to think that maybe it wasn't, you know, that kind of a line of, you know, provenance, but in any event, you know, the Urim and Thummim, you know, we tend to think of that as the Nephite interpreters. Like you say, there are some, statements that refer to the seer stone as a Urim and Thummim. You know, and so that's where I think some of the confusion lies, is that they're not using the language very precisely. What does the word Urim and Thummim mean?
It means lights and perfections in Hebrew.
Okay, and so I think that's interesting. If we think that maybe these are the stones that were lit up when the Jaredites crossed, you know, over to the Promised Land. You know, if these are lights and perfections, it would make sense that they were lighting up a barge, right? Also, I suppose, you know, it's interesting to think about how if you're putting this stone in a hat and trying to cover it out, you know, to filter out any light that's coming from the room, that you're still able to see something. It maybe indicates that there's some kind of light coming from the stone. Which, you know, maybe would suggest you should call this a Urim and Thummim, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a little bit of a complicated and confusing history. You know, I can see how, you know, people may have differences of opinion about how some of this works. You know, I guess I'm a little confused about, I'm still confused about why it's such a big deal. Where, I mean, they're going to the extent of claiming that if you believe that a seer stone was used, then you must not really be a good member of the church. You must not be, you know, you must not believe the scriptures, right?
Yeah.
How do they deal with the fact that, you know, I can still remember right now thinking about President Nelson demonstrating for us, you know, on a video clip about how Joseph Smith translated, and he talked about putting a stone in a hat, and President Nelson puts his face down toward this hat. How does Jonathan Neville respond to that kind of evidence?
Yeah, I remember watching an interview he did on YouTube once where he says that, oh, President Nelson wasn't telling us this is how the translation happened. He was just demonstrating a possibility. But when you watch the video, it seems abundantly clear that President Nelson is talking about this is how we know the translation happened based on the historical record. He even says we know they had the plates covered usually, and Joseph would put the Urim and Thummim seer stones in the hat, and he'd even demonstrated at that point.
Well, there are numerous articles, you know, in the Ensign. We have Gospel Topics essays that talk about this. How does Jonathan Neville respond to those points of data?
So he does actually attack the Ensign multiple times along with Saints, Volume 1, for talking about the seer stone. Once he even doctored a, I don't know if doctored would be the right word, or photoshopped, but he took the January 2020 Ensign and stuck the cover of Mormonism Unveiled on top of it and said, because this Ensign is has this article written by Elder LeGrand R. Curtis talking about the seer stone, he is just repeating all of the claims made in Mormonism Unveiled, this 1834 anti-Latter-day Saint book. And what's also funny...
Let me just mention really quick, LeGrand Curtis is currently the church historian. He's a General Authority 70, and he's over the Church History Department right now, right?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. You were going to say something else?
Yeah, and that is also funny because in the same book, Jonathan Neville, where he attacks the Ensign for talking about the seer stone and saying that it's just repeating all of these claims made in Mormonism Unveiled, actually in multiple places defends Mormonism Unveiled and some affidavits made in it attacking Joseph's character, as well as another anti-Latter-day Saint source called Mormonism Research Ministry. He says that some people have, you know, gotten mad at him for referring people to their website, but they're just providing a resource.
Right, so Mormonism Unveiled is maybe the first anti-Mormon book that was published, and Mormon Research Ministries is one of the most recent evangelical efforts to, they call themselves, you know, a ministry. It's the, well, how would they describe it? It's a Mormon ministry or a... I can't remember what the occult counter-cult ministry. There we go, and so you're saying that Jonathan Neville cites these sources with approval.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess if you can't cite the Ensign with approval, you got to turn to something.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked earlier about how there are witnesses to the use of a seer stone. We have David Whitmer, Ann Whitmer, Martin Harris, you know, numerous others. So let's take Martin Harris, for example. What does Jonathan Neville say in response to the argument that Martin Harris said, I saw Joseph Smith using a stone in a hat, and I was worried that maybe he's making this up, or at least I want to be able to tell others about how this process worked and that it's legit. And so I exchanged the stone myself and saw that he wasn't able to translate. So I know that this is how the process worked. What did Jonathan Neville say about that?
He had quite a few different theories about this, one of which was that Martin Harris just became essentially a confused and addled old man who, because there's this incident that Edward Stevens relates where Martin Harris, before he came out to Utah, was walking home and got hit by a weak spell and fell down. And then eventually he was able to get up and he was completely better. He was able to work in the field and there was no health issues reported whatsoever. But Neville says that this may have actually affected Martin Harris's memory. And because of this, then Martin Harris talks about Joseph using a seer stone. The big issue with this claim, however, is that even before this weak spell hit Martin, we have a source of him talking about the seer stone published in Tiffany's magazine.
So when was Martin Harris supposed to have gotten hit?
If I remember correctly, like 1870s, early 1870s.
Okay. And well before that, he talked about Joseph using a seer stone.
Yes.
Okay. And then well after that, he continually talks about Joseph Smith's translation of the Book of Mormon, that he, you know, Martin Harris saw an angel, you know, and he's talking a lot about the Book of Mormon and his testimony. Is there any evidence that anybody thought that Martin Harris was demented, that, you know, that he had Alzheimer's or something?
No, in fact, people actually are impressed, even late into his life, at how clear Martin's memory is. And Martin is talking with such clarity and openness about this whole process. Any sign of dementia or any other mental illness that that would have gone noticed in the historical record, but the complete opposite is actually true.
What about David Whitmer and Ann Whitmer? What can you tell us about Jonathan Neville's response to their reports?
He believes that the seer stone narrative especially came about because David and Elizabeth Whitmer and Emma Smith all wanted to refute the Solomon Spaulding theory, which said that essentially Joseph Smith got this lost manuscript by a guy named Solomon Spaulding and just passed that off as the Book of Mormon. And so if they were to get rid of the curtain between Joseph and the scribe, they could easily dismiss that Joseph could have possibly done this. And one of the things that they say is, well, that Neville says, is that they may have been influenced by William E. McClellan, who had since left the church and had become antagonistic to Joseph Smith personally. And also, he claims that they may have not even seen Joseph Smith translate with the seer stone, but they saw him recite Isaiah from memory as he put the seer stone in a hat. And so then they just said, oh, this must be Joseph translating, when Joseph was really just reciting a biblical text from memory.
So I suppose what Jonathan Neville is saying is that much of what Joseph Smith was doing was sort of religious theater, I guess, that he is trying to put on a show where he's memorized the text of the Book of Mormon or the text of Isaiah, and that he is trying to, well, he's duping those around him into thinking that he's receiving revelation. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, one of the other things that Jonathan Neville has hypothesized is that Joseph Smith relied not only on Isaiah, but on Jonathan Edwards for his translation of the Book of Mormon. And so you've written a paper called Jonathan Edwards' Unique Role in an Imagined Church History, responding to Jonathan Neville's book, Infinite Goodness, Joseph Smith, Jonathan Edwards, and the Book of Mormon. First of all, who is Jonathan Edwards?
So Jonathan Edwards was an early American theologian and preacher in the First Great Awakening, so probably 60 years before Joseph Smith was born. He lived in that time period. His most famous sermon that I feel like most people would be familiar with is called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
All right, so very well-known theologian, very influential. His writings would have been generally known. So how is it that somebody who purports to believe that the Book of Mormon is scripture would come to the conclusion that this 19th century preacher influenced the text of the Book of Mormon? What's the theory?
So his theory is that Joseph Smith read from at least 8 volumes of Jonathan Edwards in Palmyra, New York, and that Joseph just added all of this language to his mental language bank, he calls it. And then whenever Joseph Smith uses certain terms in the translation, such as natural man, he is expecting his readers to know that he is instead referring to Jonathan Edwards and trying to build off of this theological groundwork laid by Jonathan Edwards.
Is there any evidence that Joseph Smith owned any copies of any books by Jonathan Edwards?
No.
Is there any evidence that Joseph Smith ever checked out a Jonathan Edwards book from the library?
No. The closest that we have and that Neville has to offer is that those 8 volumes were on sale in Palmyra, and Joseph Smith would go to the Palmyra print shop to pick up a newspaper once a week for his father. And a late anti-source claims that Joseph Smith was lounging and idle and of a weak mind, and he would go and into town and bother the people who were running the Ramage Press, and so they would blacken his face with ink. And because Joseph Smith was in the print shop once a week, Neville claims that this gives him the time and opportunity and means to read from 8 whole volumes of Jonathan Edwards.
This man with the addled mind is consuming Jonathan Edwards and then repurposing it into a new text.
Yeah, it's a. He does not provide any strong evidence. In fact, even in his book, he says that we aren't dealing with any conclusive direct evidence, and so we can only guess. But he constantly raises his opinion and then states it as a fact and then moves off of that assumption.
Well, so what are some of the points of data that Jonathan Neville purports to rely on for this conclusion?
One of the phrases is the name of his book, Infinite Goodness, but even by his own admission, he says that Jonathan Edwards was not the first nor the only theologian in the time period to use that term, infinite goodness. And Stephen Carmack has even said that it's been around since the 1500s. Another point that he raises is the Book of Mormon describes how the Holy Messiah would take away the sins of the world, plural sins. And so he quotes from an article talking about this, and he says that this article, when it says sin of the world, singular, it's misquoting the scriptures, because everyone knows that it's 2 Nephi says sins of the world. But this paper that Neville is quoting from is quoting from Royal Skousen's early, the Book of Mormon, the earliest text. And according to Skousen, the earliest text that we have, like the original manuscript, says Jesus would take away the sin, singular, of the world. And that extra S was just added by the typesetter later on. And so Neville misrepresents his data there in order to try and pass off his theory as a fact.
So what I hear you saying is that there are these stray phrases that appear in the Book of Mormon that also appear in Jonathan Edwards' writings. And because of that, Jonathan Neville claims that Joseph Smith must have relied on Jonathan Edwards in translating the Book of Mormon.
And not only phrases, but even solitary words as well, that simple, and even like changing a verb from a present tense to a past tense form. If the past tense form appears in Jonathan Edwards but doesn't have a strong connection in the Bible, then it must mean that Joseph Smith learned that form of the verb from Jonathan Edwards, which is very weak evidence.
You list some of them here. Prayer, the first vision, the temple endowment. What can you tell us about those phrases and words in particular, about how Jonathan Neville uses those to show that Joseph Smith relied on Jonathan Edwards?
Yeah, in addition to just textual wordplay between the Book of Mormon and Jonathan Edwards, he believes that Edwards had a theological impact on Joseph Smith. So the Book of Mormon talks about the natural man not wanting to pray, but the Spirit of God teaches us to pray always. And Jonathan Edwards talked about something similar, so he must have got that idea from Jonathan Edwards. Unfortunately for his hypothesis is that that phrase and those pairings of those phrases about wanting to avoid prayer because of the natural man appears in texts other than Jonathan Edwards, and it was just a common theological understanding of Joseph Smith's time. And so it would make sense for Joseph Smith as a translator of the Book of Mormon to take an ancient text and be able to translate it in terms and phrases that he was familiar with because of that.
All of his work with Neville's work with this Jonathan Edwards text reminds me of the earlier claims that were popular some 20 years ago about how Joseph Smith used a book called The View of the Hebrews as a basis for the text of the Book of Mormon and the ideas in there. I wonder if and I'm thinking of an article that John W. Welch put together called The View of the Hebrews, an Unparalleled, talking about all the differences in the View of the Hebrews and in the Book of Mormon narrative. I'm wondering if you could describe, just give us a brief summary of kind of an unparalleled version. You know, what's different about Jonathan Edwards' writings versus the Book of Mormon? It seems like, you know, if we're only looking at tiny, you know, points of parallel, maybe you can make a case for something. But in the bigger picture of things, is this really an unparalleled?
Yeah. One of the points that he raises is about plural marriage or polygamy. He cites Jonathan Edwards as talking about King Solomon, who married multiple wives, and this was a type of Christ in the last days, and Solomon was exempt from the law of Moses because he was allowed to have all of these wives. And so Joseph Smith got the idea of plural marriage from Jonathan Edwards. But when you read the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants 132, exactly the opposite is actually said. Solomon is condemned for multiplying wives to himself, breaking the law of the kings in Deuteronomy 17. And Solomon and David are especially shown as not being exempt from the law of Moses. Exactly the opposite point that Jonathan Edwards was making is made by the Lord in these revelations. Let's see. Another one would be the phrase a preparatory state. So Jonathan Edwards claims that Joseph Smith got the idea of a preparatory state, a phrase that appears in the Book of Mormon, from Jonathan Edwards. But when you look at what's actually said between the two. Jonathan Edwards uses the term a preparatory state to talk about the earth in the millennia leading up to Christ's birth, how the earth was in this preparatory state awaiting the birth of Christ. When that phrase is used in the Book of Mormon, however, a completely different reading is given. That is, our preparatory state is our mortal probation, this time to prepare to meet God. So don't procrastinate the day of your repentance.
That is interesting. Thank you for that. It reminds me of, I think a lot of the arguments about Mormons and, you know, Masonry could use the same kind of treatment. There are a lot of parallels between, you know, what the saints do and, you know, use and what the Masons are doing in their temples. But if you look at, you know, some of the specifics, their, you know, purposes are entirely different. So I appreciate that insight.
You know, this reminds me of a blog post that Jeff Lindsay, who's a board member of the Interpreter Foundation, wrote a few years ago. It's entitled, "Was the Book of Mormon Plagiarized from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass?" And it's a satirical piece, of course, because Leaves of Grass was written after the Book of Mormon. But Jeff Lindsay puts together these, you know, words and phrases that, you know, are common to the Book of Mormon and Leaves of Grass. He takes words or names that are similar. So crewman in Leaves of Grass to cumin in the Book of Mormon. Alamo to Alma. Both of them use the word ether. Chemist and chemish, it's great. You know, you can take about anything. We could take Moby Dick, you know, and find words and phrases that are similar and say, aha, we found the source of the Book of Mormon. That sounds about like what Neville's doing here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he even, one claim made by a lot of antis is that Joseph Smith used other books like The Late War, or the first book of Napoleon, in to come up with his own version of the Book of Mormon. And Neville gives these claims some credence and says, yeah, in fact, I think he did use the Late War, because both the Late War and the Book of Mormon have a title page, a copyright page, and a preface.
Wow. Direct hit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of flabbergasting that you know, somebody who would purportedly believe that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon by the gift of power and God would rely upon all of these different sources and memorize, you know, the Book of Isaiah and try to dupe his friends into thinking he was doing something different.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
This is the Interpreter Foundation radio show, sponsored by LDSAgents.com. The Interpreter Foundation exists to encourage study of the gospel and faithfulness to the church by making the latest scholarship available in its journal, publishing books, holding seminars, creating documentary films, and by providing roundtable discussions of the scriptures. You can find us at interpreterfoundation.org, where you can find all of our materials, including these radio programs that are posted as podcasts. You can also subscribe to this show in iTunes or through any of the other podcast apps on Apple and Android devices. If you like the show, tell your friends about us. Write a review on iTunes or on your favorite site for podcast apps. My name is Steve Densley, and tonight we are talking about the Book of Job in our Come Follow Me roundtable discussion. Mark Johnson is with me in the studio, and Spencer Krause is also with me, and Professor Matthew Bowen is joining us by phone from Brigham Young University, Hawaii. Aloha, Professor Bowen.
Aloha, Steve, Mark, Spencer.
Aloha.
Mark, why don't we start out by acknowledging the generosity of our sponsor, LDS Agents.
I'd be happy to. Our sponsor is LDSAgents.com. It's a network of over 3,000 real estate agents serving Latter-day Saints across the United States and Canada for more than 20 years. They've been helping Latter-day Saints like you find homes in safe neighborhoods with the right schools, including schools for special needs, and a temple not far away. Everyone at LDSAgents.com speaks your language. So why not let LDSAgents.com reduce the stress of buying or selling a home? Go to their website and take a look around at all they can do for you. LDSAgents.com. One more time, that's LDSAgents.com.
So tonight in our Come Follow Me discussion, we're going to be addressing, most of the book of Job. The chapters that are listed in the Come Follow Me discussion are chapters 1 through 3, 13 through 14, 21 through 24, 38 through 40, and chapter 42. We'll probably touch on some of the chapters in between. I think that people ought to read the whole book. Victor Hugo, about the book of Job, said, "The book of Job is perhaps the greatest masterpiece of the human mind." And he said, "Tomorrow, if all literature was to be destroyed and it was left to me to retain one work only, I should save Job." Tennyson said, "It's the greatest poem, whether of ancient or modern literature." Daniel Webster said, "The book of Job, taken as a mere work of literary genius, is one of the most wonderful productions of any age or any language." And Thomas Carlyle said, "There is nothing written, I think, in the Bible or out of it of equal merit." So, Professor Bowen, can you tell us about where the book of Job fits in the biblical canon?
We have the threefold division of the Hebrew Bible. It's often referred to by the acronym Tanakh, which stands for Torah, the T, the Nevi'im, the prophets, and the Ketubim, the writings. The Torah, of course, is the five books of Moses. The Nevi'im is the everything from Joshua and the other historical books, 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, and the prophetic books. And then you have the writings, which include Psalms, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, and so the book of Job, it falls within that last category of the threefold division. It's a part of the writings, the Ketubim.
So this is sort of recognized in the Hebrew Bible as basically a book of poetry. Is that fair to say?
Clearly the five books of Moses carried more weight for, in ancient Judaism. And even now in many ways, and then the prophets, and then, the writings, seem to have, even carry a little bit lighter weight in terms of, their authority.
There are different genres in the scriptures. And by that I mean we may have one book of scripture that is historical. Another book, might be, telling us a story or reciting a poem or giving us lists of, good ideas on how to conduct ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mark, can you tell us about genre literature within the Hebrew Bible?
Well, it's important that we know about that because I think we can often bring our own expectations and our own, cultural reading habits to, these ancient texts, which might not have, conformed to the same expectations that we have. It's easy for us to start reading the scriptures and it being a honest to goodness, word for word, day by day account of what we call history. But if we're aware of, just different kinds of genres, we might not, be able to, we might not fall into that same kind of trap, but we can appreciate the text for what it is. As an example, if I was to tell you, a story about my friend James, who came from Ireland, you might think, oh, this is history. But if I started off by saying, let me tell you of, Jimmy O'Rourke, who hails from a town north of Cork, you might think, oh, this actually isn't history. This is a limerick. you know, this is an entirely different different thing than history. Jimmy still might exist. He might be a real person, but that's not the point of the genre. You know, it's to tell a different kind of story or to, you know, make a funny point. It's the same with the different genres of the Bible. There's a lot of overlap with other, you know, other cultures, you know, in antiquity, as well as the Book of Mormon. You know, you've got different genres, like, you know, these books of wisdom literature, which talk about, you know, ways to thrive in the land and to please God and to, you know, acquire honor for yourself.
So in the New Testament, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, maybe a good example of this would be that Jesus often spoke in parables.
He did.
So we might hear a recitation of a story of a good Samaritan, mm-hmm. you know, who's traveling between Jerusalem and Jericho, and there are certain facts that are related to us, and then there's sort of a point, you know, to mm-hmm. to this story. Now, I suppose there might have been a good Samaritan. This might have actually related true history.
Oh, it might have, yeah.
But the purpose of relating it was not so much to relate the history of the story as it was to prove some other point.
Right, to talk about, you know, in this case, Christ was asking, you know, his audience who their neighbor was. You know, in the point of this parable, or, you know, in the parable, you know, the existence or reality of this good Samaritan is kind of secondary. That's, I think, what we find throughout a lot of biblical literature. The authors are giving us the stories of Adam and Eve and Abraham and Moses and David, but, you know, they can't give us necessarily the actual Abraham or Adam. You know, we've got, you know, quoted words here and there, but to give us the stories and to give us the stories that the authors and the narrators want to tell us, they have to create and shape the stories. You know, you have to leave out certain details. You know, we find this in the Synoptic Gospels. You know, quite frequently, the authors of the Gospels will, you know, some of them will leave out, you know, different stories. Other times, you know, we find Christ performing miracles out of order based, you know, as they're presented in a different gospel or teaching a sermon, you know, in a different place than what happened in the earlier gospel. And each of the, of these biblical authors, is doing that, shaping their accounts to deliver, the maximum impact for their listeners and their readers. So things that are in these biblical texts are, you know, likely based on, you know, most of the time real people. It might not always be the case, but that's not the point that the author was trying to make. In the Book of Job, for instance, you know, the author was not trying to prove to us that, you know, Job existed and that he lived at a certain time and from a certain place. You know, that wasn't his focus, his intent of writing that. He was, you know, putting all these and compiling all these, you know, bits of wisdom and advice together to answer, you know, in this case, a specific question about, you know, mortal suffering and how, you know, how does God relate to that suffering?
Well, much of the Book of Job is told through poetry, and this appears in the writings, you know, along with wisdom literature, such as Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Sometimes it comes across sounding very much like Proverbs or Ecclesiastes or Psalms. But Professor Bowen, are there examples in, you know, the law and in the prophets where poetry is used to describe actual events?
Yeah, the poetry is found throughout the entirety of the Hebrew Bible in different ways in different places. For example, you know, it just in Come Follow Me, with which a lot of church members are familiar with. You know, you got that phrase, Saul hath killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands, that's phrased as a poetic couplet, and you'll have it just dropped there in the narrative as a, you know, as a, an important part of what the author is trying to say. And you find it in, you know, snatches of poetry or nuggets of poetry throughout the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. And of course, you know, when Nephi talks about the manner of the prophesying of the Jews, I think he has reference to in no small part to the way in which we find prophecy recorded in ancient Israel, and it's laid down in poetic verse largely. And so, you know, just recognizing poetry where it occurs, even in translation, is important to understanding how scripture is trying to convey its various messages.
All right, so the fact that something is related to us as poetry maybe gives us a clue as to how we should interpret the message, or, you know, what message we should be looking for, but doesn't necessarily help us know whether the events are historical or not. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it has no... It's similar to, you know, you see things that are sometimes ideological. Whether something's being told in an ideological way has no... You know, in and of itself, it has no bearing on whether it's historical or not. And that's sort of the same thing with, you know, poetry in a lot of contexts. It's and again, getting back to what Mark was saying about genre, we have to be careful that we don't get so caught up in the ancillary issues that we miss the main point of what a text is attempting to convey. And the reason the book of Job is considered what some have called the crown jewel of biblical literature is because of its message and the dialogue and the theological themes that are being worked with. And if we miss those, we're missing the point of the book.
Right. What do we know about the author of Job? You know, the book itself doesn't tell us who the author is. Do we know anything aside from that?
We don't know a lot, and it could have multiple authors. And one of the way that, for example, Elihu's speeches intrude into the text may be an indication of, you know, of that multiple authorship, with that speech being perhaps secondary to the original book.
Well, and then the fact that we'll talk a little bit about this in a few moments, but the structure shifts back and forth. So we have what has been called a frame to the whole book that is in prose, and kind of outlines the you know, the general setting and the characters that are involved in the story, and then it launches into this extended poetry that you know makes up most of the book, and then reverts back into prose, you know, to kind of complete the framing. Some people have proposed that maybe this indicates that there are multiple authors, that you have the frame maybe, you know, is one author, the poetry maybe is another. And then, as you say, you know, Elihu, you know, kind of takes a different approach than the other, you know, friends of Job. And maybe this signals another author.
And there have been some people who say that like the prologue and the epilogue, as Steve mentioned, were written by one author, and they would describe that as they've called that as the author of they called it Job the Patient, and then they call the poetry sections is written by Job the Impatient.
Well, and I've seen all sorts of theories about who may have offered this. Some people think maybe Moses, maybe somebody named Job authored it, or, you know, Elihu.
Maybe Shakespeare. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, Solomon, Isaiah, Hezekiah, Baruch, Jeremiah's scribes. The biblical commentators, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, said, "All that can be said with certainty is the author was a loyal Hebrew who was not strictly bound by the popular creed that assumed suffering was always the direct result of sin." The other thing that's interesting is that there are other stories like this that, you know, are floating around, many that predate Job. It may be that, you know, like the flood stories, or like Tower of Babel stories, you know, it may be that this was a story that was kind of generally known and other cultures recorded it.
There's other analogs of those, like the flood story you mentioned with Gilgamesh. And
so they've found similar stories among the Akkadians, Babylonians, Hittites, you know, and so there's debate about when it was written. Was mm-hmm. this written, you know, during the time of Moses? Was it written during the time of Solomon, or during the Babylonian exile? We don't know a lot about any of these issues. The setting itself seems to be sometime maybe during the patriarch era, you know, Adam or Abraham, mm-hmm. Isaac, Jacob. It doesn't seem to be set, you know, post Mosaic code,
right? Because a lot of the things in the Mosaic code aren't really pertinent to the story. The reverence for the Torah and you know, all the many numerous sacrifices are, you know, quite
the way
absent.
In which sacrifices are carried out.
Mm-hmm. Plus,
the age ascribed to Job as well at the end suggests uh-huh. that, you know, perhaps it's conceived of as occurring earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does have ages in common with a lot of the earlier patriarchs. Plus, he's also described as someone having, like Abraham, the same blessing of many camels and sheep and, you know, she asses and all these things. So,
yeah, and now it's been argued that the opening and closing of the book are very similar to other historical works of the Bible. You know, and so maybe that gives us a hint that the author is intending to signal to us that this is historical. Paul quotes from it. Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 14, Job is mentioned along with Noah and Daniel, it would suggest maybe Ezekiel saw him as a historical figure. James.
Yeah, and that, in fact, I would say that's important because it suggests that, like Noah, that Job is an established figure by the time of Ezekiel, that he's well known.
Well, and that the listeners, I mean, whoever's reading Job or hearing Job, whoever's reading it or hearing Ezekiel recited, you know, it's expected that they would recognize that Job, you know, is a historical figure of the kind of like Noah or Daniel. James, the Lord's brother, refers to Job as an example of perseverance in James chapter 5, verse 11. One of the arguments for the historicity of Job as a person, Keith Masservey gave a devotional address a number of years ago. That's been relied upon by others. The argument he made was that in the Doctrine and Covenants, when Joseph Smith is in Liberty Jail suffering, that that the Lord tells Joseph Smith, "Thou art not yet as Job." You know, and so the suggestion is that, you know, that God wouldn't have said that to Joseph Smith if Job didn't really exist. I'm not convinced by that argument. I think that what we read in the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, where it says, "Thou art not yet as Job," that could easily be another way of saying things could be worse. You know, the whole book of Job could be, you know, a poetic kind of parable, and we could be saying, look, it's not that bad. So I'm not convinced by that argument, but there are other arguments, such as, you know, what Professor Bowen just said, that Ezekiel refers to Job along with other historical figures. You know, James is referring to him as a good example. Those kinds of things I find, you know, maybe more persuasive. You know, it's interesting too to think about the way that we have interpreted the book. Daniel Ludlow said that interpretations of the book of Job have been so varied and extreme that it's often been claimed that Job has suffered more from the hands of critics than he ever did from the hands of Satan. You know, there are different ways. You know, people have interpreted quite broadly, really, over the years. More recently, I think that the interpretation has been that this is, you know, basically an allegory or a parable, and you know, what does it say about the nature of our existence in this world, and you know, those interpretations have been different. One of the things that in the common understanding of the story is that this is about a guy who's very patient, and you know, we talk about the patience of Job. So that phrase, patience of Job, comes from James chapter 5, verse 11. It uses the word, and I may not be pronouncing this correctly, but Professor Bone, you can tell us what this means, hypomenen, or hypomenia.
Yeah.
What does that word mean?
It literally means to, like, continue under.
Okay, so hupo, when we say the
below,
patience of Job,
mene means to abide or continue or to remain. So, kind of the idea of remaining under certain circumstances. The more evocative word is the Latin word that's used to translate that, and that's where we get the idea of suffering, patire, the idea of suffering, long suffering.
Well, most modern Bible translations will translate this word as endurance. You know, so it might be better to say the endurance of Job rather than the patience of Job. Where patience, you know, it's like I'm patient because I'm able to accept delays or problems without being annoyed or anxious. As we get into the text, Job does become annoyed. He does become anxious. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't really be a good description of how he's relating to these trials he's experiencing. He's not simply, sitting on his hands and waiting it out. I'd go so far as to say he's complaining to God about, why is this happening? It's not unlike what Joseph Smith is doing in Liberty Jail, where Joseph Smith is saying, how long shall thou hand be stayed, and thine eye, yea, thy pure eye, behold from the eternal heavens the wrongs of thy people and thy servants, and thine ear be penetrated with their cries? Why aren't you listening? Don't you see this? You know, and I think that's very much like Job's reaction.
I agree, and I think he's got a good point, honestly. You know, it's where's justice? You know, if God is a just God, where is this justice? You know, and I think he's fair in answering that. You're asking that, and we, find a, answer a little later in the book.
Well, and, in Job chapter 21, verse 4, the King James Version says, where Job is saying, why should not my spirit be troubled? It's almost alone in translating it this way. Nearly every other translation reads, why should I not be impatient? You know, and so the text itself kind of undercuts that idea that, Job is the quintessential example of patience. So let's dive into the text here.
Steve.
Oh yeah.
Can I make just a quick comment?
Yep.
And this relates to our topic of the last hour. It's interesting to me that in Matthew 10:22, when Jesus uses the phrase "He that endureth to the end," this is one of the phrases that came up in Neville's work. But it's that the word for endure there in Matthew 10:22 is that same word. Hypomeno. It's in the form hypomenas. But it's that same term, and so that connects us with the idea of enduring to the end, in a broad sense, but also in the doctrine of Christ sense, the idea that which connects a lot with themes of Job, and the path and the way to wisdom.
Okay, Spencer, do you have anything to add to that?
I think Matt summed it up quite well.
Okay. Well, then as we get into the text, we are introduced to this man from the land of Uz. Okay, now that's another thing that people will use to say that this is, you know, kind of like, you know, saying once upon a time, or, you know, it's from the, like the Land of Oz or something, which is interesting because in when the Wizard of Oz was translated into Hebrew, the translator of the film's subtitle chose to use the Land of Uz instead of the Land of Oz. You know, and so there's, I guess, a sense that maybe this is, you know, sort of a fantastical place.
Oh, and if I could maybe have Matt, maybe just kind of build on this idea. Matt, what is the meaning of the name Job?
The meaning of the name Job?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the name means. People have transposed letters within it, you know, Job is, you switch a couple of the letters around and you end up with Oyev, which means enemy. And so you have this Midrashic idea that, you know, Job is being treated like an enemy of God, which, you know, sort of bears out in some of his complaints in the book.
You know, in terms of whether Uz is a real place or not, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the War Scroll, refers to the land of Uz as existing beyond the Euphrates. Uz is sometimes identified with the Kingdom of Edom. That's roughly in the area of southwest Jordan or southern Israel. So there are some references to this as being a real place, even though, you know, if I go to buy a plane ticket, I can't find a ticket to Uz. But it does sound like there are some reasons to think that this was a real place that existed historically. And, you know, Job is called a perfect man, upright, who feared God. He's got a lot of stuff. You know, he's got seven sons and three daughters, lots of sheep and camels and oxen and asses. And, you know, it says that his household is greatest in all the East. And then there is this, this is another reason why people, maybe suggest that Job's not historical, is that there's this, divine counsel, that takes place, where the sons of God, Joseph Smith changes that to children of God, that they come to present themselves before the Lord along with the Satan. Now, in my view, this all fits very well with Latter-day Saint doctrine, that there are such things as councils in heaven with sons and daughters of God coming together in council, and that... you know, that Satan would be among them in terms of being one who we read about Satan appearing in a council in Abraham chapter 3. So the fact that you have this kind of event doesn't, to Latter-day Saints, suggest that this should be read as an allegory or some kind of fable. This fits very well with things that we understand actually happened. But then we also have this word, the Satan. So people suggest that this is you know, some kind of a you know, mythical figure, that it's not what we would understand as Lucifer or the devil. That this is simply, you know, a person who has appeared on the scene among the sons of God, who is an adversary. So modern translations often translate, you know, Satan as the adversary, which doesn't seem to me to be a problem for Latter-day Saints either. We often refer to Satan as the adversary. Mm-hmm. What do you have to add to that, Professor Bowen?
Yeah, I was going to say you'd appreciate this in particular, since you come from a law background and are a lawyer by profession. The term HaSatan means either the adversary or the accuser, like a kind of in the sense of a prosecuting attorney in a way. And then the setting with, you know, God and the children of God, or God and the sons of God, the divine counsel is a court setting.
Right. So this would be sort of like the plaintiff. You know, the plaintiff comes along to, you know, to accuse. You know, he's the one that's bringing the case against Job.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, all of that, I mean, it's very consistent with what we would understand to be actual events. These are the kinds of things that we understand actually happen, you know, in on the other side of the veil. So the fact that we're calling him the Satan or the accuser or the adversary doesn't mean this isn't actually Lucifer. And that Lucifer is not actually saying to God, you know, I am going to go and, you know, test Job, and he tells our Heavenly Father, you know, the only reason Job follows you is that, you know, he's had it easy, and, you know, you've been protecting him. And so, you know, if you let me take all this stuff away, then Job is going to curse you. And so God allows Job to be tested in these various ways so that he loses his family, he loses his possessions. And then, you know, eventually he also is stricken severely with physical maladies. You know, and so how is it, Mark, that Job responds to this?
He takes it all in stride. I was just going to add really quickly that all of this seems to be very kind of against, you know, what we would call a prosperity gospel nowadays. You know, where God will bless you if you give, you know, your money to the guy on TV, the preacher guy there. Job responds to all of this by saying, "Well, you know, I came into this world naked, and that's guess how I'm going to leave." So. He just he takes it all in stride.
Yeah, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. You know, so in this, what, you know, it's called the frame, the, mm-hmm. you know, the, this prose section. Some people have suggested that this is, you know, maybe satirical even, that, you know, this is kind of, you know, making fun of how somebody might react to having, you know, their complete, you know, their life totally obliterated. I'm not sure I agree with that reading. I think it's possible to read all of these different elements of the story together, mm-hmm. and that maybe we see a little bit of a, you know, a shift in Job's approach, so that he's, you know, initially, I guess somewhat stoic about it, mm-hmm. And then, over time, he becomes really frustrated, but he never loses his faith.
No,
he never loses his confidence in God. He never loses his faith that God is there, and that God, you know, has power to affect this situation. He's just really frustrated that God's not using it to fix everything for him.
Yeah, and I think that that's just kind of typical of the ancient mind. They wouldn't necessarily doubt the existence of God. They would just maybe doubt if they were loyal to the right one.
Well, in chapter 2, when it talks about his physical maladies, it talks about, you know, boils from head to toe. Some people suggest this may be elephantitis. You know, his face was so deformed, his friends didn't know him. He had boils so bad that he would have to scrape them with pottery. Maggots were breeding in the sores of his body. You know, he smelled so bad that he went out to sit on the dump heap, you know, at the outside of town. Had terrifying nightmares. His wife, you know, in some sense seems to kind of, you know, give up hope and tell him to curse God and die. Job says, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What shall we receive good at the hand of God and not also receive evil?" And, you know, and later he says, "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh I shall see God." And we see that as Latter-day Saints as evidence that very early there was an understanding that we would be resurrected and that there would be a Redeemer. You know, there are others that try to discount this. I'm not convinced by that. To me, this seems like that this is some pretty good evidence that there was an understanding that there would be a redeemer, you know, someone who would pay the price for us, and that we would be resurrected.
And Steve, that's an important point when we were talking about the legal language of, you know, at the outset of the book of Job and the idea of a legal setting. The term that he uses there in Job 19 is goeli. Someone's goel was the nearest kin. It's sometimes a better translation of that phrase.
We're talking about the redeemer now, right?
Be not redeemer, but kinsman redeemer. It's a member of your family who's responsible to stand up for you in a legal setting and uphold your rights. If you've been sold off into slavery, to buy you back out of slavery, to buy back family property that's been sold off, and so forth. And so, you know, with so you have the idea, Job's idea, that he has a goel in heaven to match the figure of the accuser, to counteract the charges of the accuser in that heavenly court.
Right. And so, you know, some people say that he's just talking about, you know, any old guy that's going to come and, you know, redeem him. But it doesn't seem to me that the text requires that, and that it makes sense to talk about a redeemer as Christ.
In any case, a goel was never just any old person. And in the divine sense, you know, that's one of the most important points of the book of Isaiah, is that Yahweh is the goel of Israel. He's Israel's kinsman redeemer.
Okay, that's a great point. Thanks. Then Job has these, you know, they're called friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, that come and they sit with him for 7 days just speechless. I suppose that could be interpreted as, they're doing the best they can because they just don't know what to do, and they're sitting with him, which in some cases that may be all we can do. And Job at this point now, he wishes to die.
They should have sat and listened.
Right.
The problem is, and I think this is one of the reasons the dialogue with the three friends is even in there, as we're these three friends are modeling how we should not approach people who are suffering and struggling. Later, Elihu makes the point about Job's limited perspective, which Job later acknowledges that he's speaking from a limited perspective. But also the three friends are completely monochromatic in the way that they think. You know, their whole approach is you must have done something. There's no way you would be suffering unless you'd done something. It's like Mark said earlier, you know, this is one of these, you know, it operates on the same thinking as the prosperity gospel. The idea that, if you're prospering, you must be doing it right, or on, you know, the opposite. If you're suffering, it's necessarily because you have been sinning. And I think that's one of the main points that the book is making, is that we should not approach people who are suffering the way that these three friends do.
Yeah, in logic, this is called the fallacy of affirming the consequent. So the way that works is that the fact that we could explain this in terms of, you know, if A then B is true, then B then A is true as well, and that's the fallacy. So, for example, if it's true to say that sinners will suffer, you know, eventually at least, that, you know, his friends are saying that it's also true then that people who are suffering must be sinners. But it's a logical fallacy. It doesn't follow to say that just because, you know, we suffer when we do things that are wrong, that doesn't mean that if we are suffering, we must have done something wrong. And this book, in some sense, is an extended illustration of that. That, you know, we've got Job, who's, you know, who's described as being perfect, and, you know, repeatedly is saying, I didn't do anything wrong, and, you know, why am I going through this? And his friends, so-called friends, are saying, well, obviously you did something wrong, otherwise you wouldn't be suffering. And like you say, Professor Bowen, this book is very forcefully and repeatedly and loudly proclaiming that that's false doctrine.
I like all this. There's a little excerpt I want to read out of the Encyclopedia Judaica on the book of Job. It talks about one essay that talks about how the book of Job is a handbook on pastoral care, and it says, to be more precise, the book of Job is not about the vocation of rabbis or other clergy that includes visiting the sick and the bereaved. In fact, most of the book of Job deals with the question of how not to behave when attempting to carry out these obligations of you know, what we'd call ministry, you know, with respect to the sick and the bereaved among us. You know, it's clear that, you know, perhaps the three friends of Job did their best work during that first week.
So Joseph Smith said that it is an unhallowed principle to say that such and such have transgressed because they have been preyed upon by disease or death. For all flesh is subject to death, and the Savior has said, judge not, lest ye be judged. And Joseph Smith also said that those who accuse place themselves in the seat of Satan. That's so interesting, considering that Satan means the accuser.
And
and that's what the word devil means too. Diabolos means a slanderer, someone who, you know, launches an attack on or an accusation at somebody.
Yeah, and I think it's also pertinent with that quote from Joseph Smith in Kirtland after the Kirtland Safety Society failed and Joseph Smith got really sick. A lot of the apostates were saying, oh, this must be happening because Joseph is a fallen prophet now. And it's falling into that same kind of pattern where, you know, they're assuming that because Joseph is suffering that he must have sinned, which I think could also give a lot of context to that as well.
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about how it is we should approach those who are suffering, you know, I like what Alma says at the Waters of Mormon, you know, those who are willing to mourn with those who mourn, you know, come forward and be baptized. You know, sometimes that's all we can do when people are mourning. You know, Job's friends want to lecture him. You know, I think in some sense they want to fix the problem. You know, they want to say, look, if you would just straighten up and fly right, then, you know, then this wouldn't be an issue. And, you know, again, we just don't know that that's why somebody has encountered problems. You know, very often it is the case that, you know, somebody's done something wrong, and that they're suffering for it, but it doesn't really help, you know, to say this is your own fault, you brought this on yourself. If we want to lift them up and help them to recover, maybe from self-inflicted wounds, we're probably more well advised to mourn with them for the things that they are experiencing and show them love and compassion rather than offer a lecture or a sermon. You know, Job, the book of Job, I think also addresses these issues of, you know, whether it's necessary for us to really understand everything. You know, Job is trying to understand, and his friends seem to have it all figured out, and they're telling him, well, this is really what's going on. Eventually what happens then is God appears on the scene. And he chastises Job for questioning him. You know, it's like, you know, Job, you know, I was listening to you. I did hear you. You know, you have no idea how this all works. You know, you weren't there when I, you know, created the world, and you know, you just don't, you don't understand. I'm the one that sees the end from the beginning. You know, Harold B. Lee commented on this. He says, it's not the function of religion to answer all questions about God's moral government of the universe, but to give courage through faith to go on in the face of questions he never finds the answer to in his present status. Therefore, take heed of yourselves. And as a wise world thinker once said, if the time comes when you feel you can no longer hold to your faith, then hold to it anyway. You cannot go into tomorrow's uncertainty and dangers without faith. I think that's one of the main the main messages of Job, is that we don't need to understand why this is happening to us. We don't need to have the answers. We need to have faith. You know, we need to, you know, demonstrate our loyalty to God. We've made covenants. You know, and that's what faith, in some sense, means is trust. You know, that, you know, though he slay me, I will trust in him. President David O. McKay said that the purpose of the book of Job was to emphasize the fact that the testimony of the Spirit, the testimony of the gospel, is beyond the power of Satan's temptations or any physical influence. So if we have, trust in God, that, you know, that will help us to endure. And, you know, maybe we ought to be coining the phrase the endurance of Job rather than the patience of Job. But I really like what John S. Tanner said. John Tanner was, he was the president of your university.
Yes, he was.
Matt, and he was also, what was he, the first counselor in the, it was in the Sunday school presidency?
Yeah, he was in the Sunday school presidency for a while, too.
Right. So he said the book of Job is at bottom about the need for revelation. Revelation is the key to human crises of faith brought on by suffering. This interpretation fits our theology, which stresses the need for both general and personal revelation. That the Lord responds at all assures us that he is not just a Deus absconditus, as Job fears, but a God who condescends to reveal himself to us in our darkest hours of need. Mark, you have in front of you a book of presentations that were given at a Temple on Mount Zion conference.
I do, yeah.
Where one of the presenters looked at Job in a temple context. Can you tell us about that?
I can. It's from the Second Interpreter Foundation conference on the temple. It is called Job, an LDS Reading. It was written by Max Sterling, and he talks about how, as you go through the narrative of the book of Job, how it resembles a lot of the contents and overall form of our modern temple endowment, how it starts off by living in idyllic circumstances. Then Job has a fall from grace. He's, you know, outside in the lone and dreary world. He's living in ashes, and he's put to a lot of tests to test his loyalty to God, to test his commitments. And then finally, at the end, he is God again returns to him, and he's brought back into God's presence, and receives a fullness of blessings.
I think that's great. It's called Temple Insights. It's published by the Interpreter Foundation. It's volume 2 in the Proceedings of the Interpreters, Matthew B. Brown Memorial Conference, Temple of Mount Zion.
And you can find the book on the Interpreter Foundation website if you'd like to order a copy for
yourself. Yeah, and the article's there too, because it was published separately in the journal as well.
Oh, that's right, it was.
You know, in wrapping this up, I think that Michael Austin, in his book on Job, I thought made an insightful comment where he said that, as countless readers have pointed out, the book of Job does not answer the question, why do bad things happen? It does, however, tell us that humanity's most common answer to this question is wrong. Material misfortunes, the poet insists, do not trace back to moral choices in any way that human beings can evaluate. There are profound consequences to knowing this. It means that paying tithing won't always make our finances work out, and that going to the temple won't ensure that our children go on missions. It tells us that some people will do everything that they are supposed to do and still experience profound tragedies, while others will flout all the laws of God and die rich, old, and in bed. It means that the universe does not belong to the category of things we can predict or control. You know, and then following up on that, I like what John Tanner says about that, that, you know, we need revelation, and that in the end, you know, like Mark was describing it, you know, Job passes back through the veil into the presence of God, and, you know, he doesn't necessarily get answers to his questions, doesn't necessarily know why it is this was happening, but he does know that, that God lives and that his Redeemer lives. In this way, we can be inspired by Job's endurance. Yes, Professor Bowen.
Yeah, if I could just make one quote or make one comment before we sign off on this. It's interesting that, you know, Job does, he's brought back into the presence of God, but it's, you know, he's been sanctified by what he's experienced. He's been changed by it. He doesn't go back into the presence of God the same way he was. And that helps us see the connection with the plan of salvation. And I also like how at the end, when God restores to Job twofold, it's interesting to me that he doesn't get the double number of the children that he had before. And as you know, several biblical commentators have noted previously, that suggests that the idea that that Job's original children that perished aren't totally lost to him, so that he doesn't need to receive twofold more of children in the restoration, but that and anyone who's lost a child will know that, you know, you don't just replace the child by having another one, but the idea seems to be present there that, you know, that first set of children aren't fully or irrevocably lost to Job.
That they will be with him beyond the veil, and that he will have even more children than he had before. Yeah, I think that's a great insight. Thanks for joining us on the Interpreter Foundation's Come Follow Me roundtable discussion of Job. This is KTalk Radio, and join us next week.